Huge news, Wayfair shoppers. There's still time to shop Wayfair's Cyber Week sale. Right now, you can score up to 70% off everything home. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, seasonal decor, and way more. Plus, with Wayfair's fast and easy shipping, everything home comes right to your home, just in time for the holidays. So don't wait. Save up to 70% off during Wayfair's Cyber Week sale. Now through December 7th at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving deep into the multifaceted life and, frankly, singular career of Nicholas David Offerman.
Yeah.
You've given us this fantastic stack of sources detailing a journey that, well, it starts in the quiet, practical world of Illinois carpentry and somehow ends up, you know, winning an Emmy for absolutely groundbreaking dramatic television.
Right.
So our mission today, really, is to synthesize the true nature of this modern Renaissance man. I mean, a figure defined as much by his ability to shape hardwood as he is by his ability to deliver that perfect deadpan comedy.
It's so essential we take this deep dive because that public persona, the iconic Ron Swanson, it's so singular, you know, so monolithic.
Totally.
But the man himself, well, he's a quadruple threat. Actor, comedian, published writer, and master carpenter. Born June 26, 1970, in Joliet, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
Offerman's career path is just, well, it's a map of self-sufficiency and some really surprising pivots.
I think what makes him so unique, really, is that he hasn't just dabbled in these fields. He's actually achieved mastery in each one. Look at this span of his career. He anchored the cultural phenomenon Parks and Recreation as Ron Swanson from, what, 2009 to 2015. But then almost a decade later, he delivers this incredible, dramatic, critical triumph.
Yeah, the Emmy win.
Winning the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Guest Actor in a Drama Series for his performance as Bill in The Last of Us. That was 2023. Just stunning.
That kind of dramatic shift, I mean, from a character whose primary attribute is like stillness and denial of emotion to one who expresses this profound, hidden vulnerability. It's phenomenal.
It really is.
And we absolutely have to recognize that the woodworking and the writing, his self-sustaining crafts, they aren't merely side projects.
No way.
They're the bedrock of his entire identity. And you could argue the key to understanding the patience and the precision in his acting.
And the whole story, it kicks off with this early contradiction, right? His parents, a nurse and a social studies teacher, were by all accounts just pillars of practical provincial sensibility there in Minooka, Illinois.
Right. Very grounded.
So when he announces his desire to enter the arts, it wasn't just a disappointment, it was bewildering for them. Offerman himself noted that nobody in our town had ever gone into the arts.
Wow.
Which just underscores the initial, almost impossible nature of his ambition. He was really starting from a place with zero professional precedent.
It truly was a leap of faith, wasn't it? But one grounded in discipline. The way he structured his early life, it really suggests that even if he wanted to pursue the, you know, ephemeral world of acting, he felt he needed a physical, dependable skill set to support it.
Makes sense.
Which leads us directly to the foundational years, the Illinois roots, the theater grit, and these unexpected skills he was cultivating sort of on the side.
So let's talk about that foundation. He was raised Catholic in Minooka, and his formal education took him to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He got a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree there in 1993.
Yep, the BFA.
So that degree gives him the acting credentials, sure, but the real grit, the real forging that came afterward in Chicago.
Exactly. The mid-1990s Chicago theater scene was brutal and brilliant, just a crucible of talent. And Offerman immersed himself fully, working with these really prestigious companies like Steppenwolf, Goodman, and Wisdom Bridge.
Yeah, big names.
This was where he didn't wait for permission, you know. He created his own opportunities.
It's such a classic story of self-determination. In 1993, like, immediately after graduating, he co-founded the Defiant Theater Company with fellow students.
Right. Defiant Theater.
That's not the move of someone just hoping for a big break. That's the move of someone committed to building the break themselves. They staged their own productions, took control of the means of creation. Pretty impressive.
And what's fascinating here is that to survive in that environment, you needed more than just talent. You needed practical utility. You had to be useful.
Right.
And this is where those hidden skills, which would later kind of define his public image, became actual professional necessities. At Steppenwolf, he wasn't just on stage acting.
No. What else?
He was also working backstage as a fight choreographer and a master carpenter.
Wait, hold on. A fight choreographer and a master carpenter at the same time.
Yep, that's the resume pairing.
That's unique. He's organizing staged chaos and literally building the scenery that supports it.
Big.
And we know the carpentry training came directly from his father, right? Which rooted the craft firmly in his family heritage.
And if you connect the dots, these skills are actually perfectly complementary. Carpentry demands meticulous planning, precision cuts, patience, absolute focus.
Okay.
Fight choreography requires timing, physical restraint, attention to detail, controlled movement. It's all discipline.
Huh. Never thought of it like that.
So when you look at his later acting, particularly the incredible stillness of Ron Swanson, you realize he's applying the disciplined control of a master craftsman to his physical presence on screen.
Yeah, you can see that.
It's the moment the artisan and the actor merge, really, and it dictates the rest of his career.
And the Chicago years, they also cemented another connection that would prove absolutely career-defining later on.
Amy Poehler.
Exactly. He first became acquainted with Amy Poehler, who was just thriving in the city's burgeoning improv comedy scene at the time. It's a perfect illustration of how just surviving in a tough arts market leads to these crucial long-term professional relationships.
It's that shared foundation of Chicago grit, I think, that really linked them. But before their careers officially intertwined in Pawnee, Indiana.
Right, before Parks and Rec.
Offerman had a decade of pure hustle. Let's look at the pre-breakthrough years, roughly, say, 1997 through 2008. This was the era of the working actor, just taking any and every role available.
And what we see in this era is a decade of, well, typecasting, often ironically mirroring his real-life skills. Like in 1998, he had a brief appearance as a construction worker in the film City of Angels.
Yeah, kind of perfect, right.
Then he started collecting guest roles basically all across the television landscape.
These roles were the backbone of his early resume, absolutely. In 1999, he played Jerry on The West Wing. Then in 2001, he had this very self-referential role on Will and Grace as Nick the Plumber.
Mm, the carpenter playing a plumber.
Exactly. He also had stints on action and procedural dramas, appearing in three episodes of 24, an episode of The King of Queens, a role in NYPD Blue. He was becoming that reliable, you know, blue-collar, slightly intense character actor Hollywood needed.
I think it's easy to overlook how much sheer stamina this requires. Just showing up, learning lines, executing the role perfectly, and moving on to the next gig.
Oh, absolutely. A grind.
He also had recurring appearances on shows that really define the early 2000s. Appeared twice on Gilmore Girls as the character Beau Belleville.
Beau Belleville, right.
And once as Jack Whitman on Monk.
But the role that really gave him a consistent recurring presence, kind of lifting him out of that one-off guest star status, was his run on George Lopez.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Between 2003 and 2004, he played Randy McGee, a factory worker who becomes the love interest of Benny Lopez. He was in eight episodes, which, you know, allowed him to develop a character over multiple storylines and gain more visibility.
And at the same time, he was getting vital film exposure, demonstrating his versatility wasn't just in TV. He appeared in the stylized neo-noir film Sin City in 2005.
Very different vibe.
Totally.
Yeah.
That same year, he played Carl Steele in the broad comedy sequel Miss Congeniality 2. And then right before his big break, he was part of that very eccentric ensemble cast of The Men Who Stare at Goats in 2009. He was working across basically every genre available.
It's just proof that there was no such thing as an overnight success here. It was a consistent, disciplined, like 10-year climb, taking roles that leveraged his physical presence and that grounded demeanor.
And then the seismic shift happened, the Ron Swanson era, which just cemented his legacy in pop culture from 2009 to 2015.
And this is where that previous Chicago connection paid off, big time. Michael Schur and Greg Daniels, the creators behind The Office, brought him on as a series regular for Parks and Recreation.
And the character description was just perfection. Ron Swanson, the deadpan, mustache-wearing, government-hating, libertarian head of the Pawnee City Parks Department. He was the perfect foil and the boss to Amy Poehler's relentlessly optimistic Leslie Knope.
The character was instantly iconic because he was built on these perfect contradictions. He worked for the government, yet he actively tried to undermine it.
Right.
He was seemingly emotionless, yet deeply sentimental about certain things. Breakfast food, woodwork, and, you know, the very few people he actually loved. As Slate magazine noted at the time, he was Parks and Recreation's secret weapon.
The critical acclaim followed almost immediately. He won the Television Critics Association Award for Individual Achievement in Comedy in 2011, sharing it with Ty Burrell.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
He was also nominated twice for the Critics' Choice Television Award for Best Supporting Actor in a Comedy Series. This was Offerman stepping fully into the cultural spotlight, largely based on his ability to perform physical comedy using just minimal facial expression. It was amazing.
And that's where the discipline of the carpenter comes right back in, isn't it? Ron Swanson's humor often relies on the meticulous timing of silence or the deliberate application of physical action.
Like the pyramid of greatness.
Exactly. Or his absolute commitment to self-sufficiency. The character's core tenet is discipline, which is a direct echo of Offerman's own commitment to craft.
But what made the character endure, I think, was the philosophical tension. Ron's intense libertarian philosophy, his belief that government should do absolutely nothing, was constantly played against Leslie Knope's equally intense social liberalism and deep belief in the power of civic engagement.
Yeah, that dynamic was everything.
They weren't just colleagues who disagreed. They were this enduring, functional friendship built on mutual respect between two totally opposed political worldviews. It was kind of hopeful, actually.
It gave the comedy real depth and prevented Ron from becoming just a simple caricature. And when asked about how he achieved that perfect straight-faced delivery, Offerman cited a surprisingly niche inspiration.
Oh, yeah.
He drew particular inspiration for supporting parts from Reverend Jim Ignatowski, Christopher Lloyd's eccentric, kind of spaced-out character in Taxi.
Reverend Jim. No way. That's brilliant.
Right. It speaks to aiming for originality and depth in every characterization, even if they aren't the main focus.
So during the peak of Parks and Recreation's success, Offerman didn't slow his pace at all. He actually expanded his reach. The success in television just accelerated his career in film and voice acting, cementing him as this versatile utility player in Hollywood.
Absolutely. Simultaneously, he was the voice of the titular character in the animated series Axe Cop for 22 episodes between 2013 and 2015.
Axe Cop, wild show.
And in film, he played Deputy Chief Hardy in the hit comedy 21 Jump Street in 2012, and he reprised that role in the sequel 22 Jump Street in 2014. These were, you know, broad comedies that really showcased his deadpan authority figure persona.
He also took chances on independent and international projects, too. Appeared in the Spanish-language comedy Casa de mi Padre in 2012.
With Will Ferrell, yeah.
And received acclaim for his role in the independent film The Kings of Summer in 2013.
And, of course, the voice work continued in major franchises. He voiced Metalbeard in the Lego Movie in 2014, making him instantly recognizable to a whole younger generation.
Everything is awesome.
Oh, exactly. His voice, much like his physical presence, is just authoritative, yet perfectly capable of that dry humor.
We also need to highlight a really crucial collaboration that happened during this period, which sort of signaled his capacity for more complex dramatic work. That was the off-Broadway one-act play Annapurna in 2014.
Right, with his wife.
He co-starred with his wife, Megan Mullally, playing an estranged couple who reunite one last time.
This performance was a fascinating preview, really. While he was famous for the mostly emotionless Ron Swanson, here he was, flexing his dramatic muscle on stage with his real-life partner, tackling these heavy themes of failed love and mortality.
So it seems like he was already seeking roles that allowed him to pivot beyond comedy, testing those dramatic chops well before Parks and Recreation actually ended.
I think so. Which perfectly leads us into the next phase, the career expansion and dramatic depth from about 2016 to the present. Once the constraints of the sitcom ended, he made a very purposeful shift into more challenging, grounded, and complex roles.
It really felt like a conscious choice to demonstrate range, didn't it? In 2016, he tackled a historical role portraying Dick McDonald.
One of the McDonald brothers.
Yeah, who, alongside his brother, established the McDonald's restaurant chain in the film The Founder. That requires portraying ambition, business acumen, and eventually the sort of disillusionment of being squeezed out of your own creation, a role far more nuanced than anything he'd done previously on TV.
And he secured a place in prestige television by playing Carl Weathers in the critically lauded second season of Fargo in 2015. That earned him a Critics' Choice Television Award nomination.
Fargo is known for its dark, complex humor and dramatic undertone.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It felt like a perfect environment for Offerman's particular skills.
We saw this trend continue with these high-profile miniseries appearances. His role as Uncle Milty in Pam and Tommy in 2022.
Right, that was quite a role.
And the complex, grounded role of Dove Porter in the series adaptation of A League of Their Own that same year. He was now really an established fixture in quality, high-end television.
But the true pinnacle of this dramatic reinvention arrived in 2023 with the HBO series The Last of Us. His performance as Bill, a survivalist who finds this unexpected love and partnership in the apocalypse, it was just stunning.
It was truly a masterclass in quiet, contained emotion. The critical response was immediate and frankly overwhelming. Many critics labeled it a career-best performance, which is a huge achievement for someone already so established.
Yeah, absolutely.
Datis Johnston, writing for Inverse, immediately labeled the performance Emmy-worthy.
And those predictions proved absolutely true. He won the Primetime Emmy Award for Outstanding Guest Actor in a Drama Series in 2023 for that performance.
Huge win.
And followed it up by winning the Independent Spirit Award for Best Supporting Performance in a New Scripted Series in 2024. This isn't just an actor changing lanes. This is an actor proving that the discipline and emotional containment he applied to comedy could translate into profound dramatic resonance.
It's the patience of the woodworker applied to acting, isn't it?
Yeah.
He took the stillness and meticulousness of Ron Swanson and channeled it into the emotional repression of Bill, allowing these tiny moments of vulnerability to land with just devastating impact.
The transition is extraordinary, but it really confirms the depth he had been building since those early Chicago theater days.
Absolutely.
And yet he hasn't abandoned the lighter side of his career either. Amidst all the dramatic accolades, he returned to his most significant professional partner, Amy Poehler, to co-host the reality competition series, making it from 2018 through 2021.
And they were great at it. Their natural chemistry and just their ability to champion craft earned them 3 Primetime Emmy Award nominations for Outstanding Host.
Which really proves his celebrity is rooted both in serious art and in this genuine, friendly, enthusiastic celebration of craftsmanship. It's a cool balance.
It really is. And the voice work continues to expand his legacy. He's contributed to Hotel Transylvania 2, Ice Age, Collision Course, and he voices Norman in the hit animated musical franchise Sing.
Norman the Pig.
Yep. And he also had that fan favorite run as Agent Powers on Gravity Falls. His voice is incredibly versatile, adapting to everything from an authoritative general to a lovable singing father figure.
And looking forward, his upcoming roles just reinforce his refusal to be categorized. He played the President of the United States in the dystopian film Civil War in 2024.
Yeah, a role that brought considerable speculation about its political resonance, which he quickly and consistently denied.
Right. He's also set to play General Sidney in the massive action tentpole mission, Impossible, The Final Reckoning in 2025, and has a co-starring role in the crime thriller Sovereign, also slated for 2025. He's actively seeking these high-profile, high-stakes roles that keep him challenging expectations.
So we've established the actor, the comedian, the dramatic force. But now we absolutely must turn to what truly grounds him, the sawdust and the satire. Let's dive deep into the Offerman woodshop and his authorial voice.
This is truly the most unique aspect of his celebrity, I think. The Offerman woodshop has been operating in Los Angeles since 2001. That's 8 years before Parks and Recreation even premiered.
Yeah, it predates the fame.
This is not some celebrity vanity project. It's a functioning, serious enterprise that employs a crew of 6 skilled craftsmen and women.
The woodshop speaks volumes about his core values. He has publicly stated that acting in TV and movies is, quote, cramping my style at the woodshop.
That's a remarkable quote from a Primetime Emmy winner.
Isn't it? He stated he'd be perfectly fine with a life dedicated solely to woodworking and live theater. This is his default setting, the place he returns to when the celebrity noise fades.
It really demonstrates a fundamental preference for physical, tangible creation over the perhaps more ephemeral nature of celebrity. It's a vocation that forces patience.
Exactly. You can't rush a dovetail joint, just like you can't rush a compelling dramatic performance. Mm. There's a parallel there.
For sure.
And his philosophy of woodworking education is also very telling. He educated himself using books and periodicals, but he emphasizes that much of the literature about the craft is often too somber and sober, focusing too much on impossible precision.
So what's his take?
His core teaching tenet is that it's essential to understand that you're supposed to make mistakes.
Ah, embracing error as part of the process. That's a crucial nugget of insight, isn't it? It's probably what allowed him to take risks in his career, too.
I think so. If you accept mistakes are part of the craft, you are far less afraid of failure.
Okay, right? Perfect sense.
And that mindset certainly informs his writing, where he applies this slightly satirical yet genuinely appreciative lens to American ruggedness and self-reliance. He's a prolific author with 4 semi-autobiographical publications, all of which he narrates as audiobooks himself.
His first, published during the peak of the Swanson years in 2013, was Paddle Your Own Canoe, One Man's Fundamentals for Delicious Living. It's like a memoir blended with life advice, celebrating self-sufficiency and simple pleasures. Very on brand.
Very much so. 2 years later, in 2015, he published Gumption, Relighting the Torch of Freedom with America's Gutsiest Troublemakers. This book was a bit more political and philosophical, celebrating historical figures he admired for their self-reliance and civic gumption, applying his own wry commentary to their legacies.
Interesting. It shows his interest in citizenship and historical figures, something we kind of see reflected in his later film choices, too.
Definitely. He followed that up in 2016 with his most craft-focused work, Good Clean Fun, Misadventures in Sawdust at Offerman Woodshop. This was a direct extension of his vocation, offering practical instruction blended with that characteristic Offerman wit and personal anecdotes about his shop crew.
Like bringing the woodshop to the reader?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And his most recent book, released in 2021, is Where the Deer and the Antelope Play, the pastoral observations of one ignorant American who loves to walk outside. This shifts more towards nature and travel, capturing his appreciation for the outdoors and linking his personal philosophy of simplicity back to the American landscape.
So across these 4 books, we see this really consistent authorial voice that blends practical advice, philosophical musing, and that self-effacing humor he's known for.
Absolutely.
Now we need to transition to the personal side, particularly his remarkable partnership with Megan Mullally, and then tackle the complex issue of his political self-definition.
Right. So Offerman married actress Megan Mullally back in 2003. They met 3 years earlier in the summer of 2000 while co-starring in a play called The Berlin Circle with the Evidence Room Theater Company.
And their relationship has become one of the most visible and professionally integrated partnerships in Hollywood. They seem like a real team.
They really are true collaborators. They've appeared together across countless mediums, often playing opposite roles or, you know, heightened versions of themselves.
That's on Will and Grace?
Yep. Will and Grace, Parks and Recreation, of course.
Where Mullesley played Ron Swanson's demonic ex-wife Tammy, too. Hilarious.
Unforgettable. Also, Hotel Transylvania 2, The Umbrella Academy, Bob's Burgers, and the miniseries You, Me, and the Apocalypse, they pop up together everywhere.
And they really embrace the joint celebrity aspect too, don't they? In 2016, they launched a live comedy tour that was famously themed around their sex life.
Huh? Yes, leveraging their comfortable, open dynamic for comedic effect. Quite bold.
They further expanded their joint media presence in 2019 by starting the podcast, In Bed with Nick and Megan, providing this relaxed, intimate space for conversation. They also co-hosted the 37th Independent Spirit Awards, showing their capacity to share the spotlight gracefully.
A true partnership.
Okay, now we come to maybe the most conflicted part of his public identity, the political self-definition, because Ron Swanson is so perfectly and consistently libertarian.
Right, the character is.
The audience naturally assumes Nick Offerman holds his exact same views. So we need to be really impartial here and just report what the sources say.
Absolutely. So when asked directly about being a libertarian in 2017, Offerman made a very critical distinction. He stated, "While I admire the philosophy of the libertarian mindset, I think it's proven to be ineffectual in actual governance. So no, I'm not. I'm a free-thinking American."
Let's just pause on that for a second, because that nuance feels crucial. The libertarian philosophy centers on ideals that Offerman clearly embodies in his life, right? Self-reliance, minimal interference, individual liberty. He admires the rugged self-sufficiency of the philosophy.
Like ideals.
But he outright rejects its practical application in governance, labeling it ineffectual.
Yeah.
So he separates the admirable ideal from what he sees as the workable political reality.
That nuanced view allowed him to offer a pretty complex critique of the 2016 election. The sources note he described Donald Trump as racist and sexist, yet simultaneously, he mocked Hillary Clinton for her private email controversy.
So he wasn't just adhering to one party line or the other. He was applying his own kind of moral accountability to both sides.
Exactly. However, Subsequent political endorsements have moved him pretty decisively away from that neutral center, demonstrating a clear preference for the Democratic Party infrastructure he had previously critiqued, at least in some ways.
Like what?
Well, he tweeted support for Elizabeth Warren in the 2020 Democratic primaries using the hashtag #VoteWarren, and later supported Charles Booker in the Kentucky U.S. Senate Democratic primary that same year.
Okay, so that's pretty clear support.
And that trend continues right up to the present. In August 2024, he went viral by endorsing Kamala Harris for the presidential election, releasing a parody song titled Proud to Be a Kamala Man. His actions show a clear evolution from someone who admires philosophy in the abstract to someone who actively supports a specific political mechanism for governance.
Despite these clear endorsements, though, his public self-description remains complex. In an April 2024 interview with GQ, he described himself as progressive, but then immediately added that he is also conservative in many ways.
Right, holding both somehow.
And he concluded by stating that he believes the semantics of the political spectrum have lost their meaning.
That view that the labels themselves are now meaningless is profoundly important, I think. It suggests that as a citizen, he feels constrained by these binary political definitions.
Yeah.
Yet as an artist, he built a huge part of his career on characters defined by absolute specific ideologies, whether it's Ron Swanson's fierce libertarianism or Bill's cynical survivalism in The Last of Us. It's a fascinating contrast.
And speaking of his art, he consciously separated politics from his recent work, like denying that his portrayal of the U.S. president in the film Civil War was based on Donald Trump.
Right. He pushed back on that.
He consistently argued that contemporary politics did not serve as an influence on the film itself, choosing to preserve the artistic vision from, you know, reductive political interpretation.
That's consistent with him, wanting the performance to be viewed as a standalone piece of art, regardless of the easy comparisons. It's another example of the disciplined boundaries he seems to set between his personal, evolving political views and the specific dramatic needs of his characters.
So what does this all mean? We've covered this incredible breadth in our deep dive, from co-founding a scrappy Chicago theater company while working as a carpenter, all the way to winning an Emmy for a career-defining dramatic role. He really is the embodiment of the advice he gives about woodworking, isn't he? Embrace the mistakes and the long, slow process.
And the final creation, in this case the career, will be stronger, more complex, and more durable.
Yeah, Offerman's journey beautifully exemplifies how deep expertise in a domain demanding physical discipline and patience, like carpentry, can unexpectedly inform and elevate seemingly unrelated fields. That grounded, contained intensity of the woodshop translated directly into the critical success of his later dramatic work.
He brought the patient hand of a craftsman to the emotional texture of his characters. You can really see the connection.
It all comes back to that initial contradiction, doesn't it? The boy, whose parents were bewildered that he wanted to enter the arts, found a way to make the arts practical, physical, and utterly essential to who he is. He didn't just become an actor, he became a maker who acts.
Well put. And here's a provocative thought for you, the listener, to maybe mull over as you process all this. We established the intense complexity of both the artistic and citizen identities of Nick Offerman. So consider the two faces. The artist who thrives by portraying characters with intensely specific, absolute moral philosophies, like Ron Swanson or Bill, and the citizen who believes political semantics have lost their meaning and kind of rejects absolute ideologies.
Yeah, that tension.
Which identity, the disciplined artist or the nuanced citizen, is ultimately the more complex construction? And maybe more importantly, how does that internal conflict speak to the challenging task of defining your own conflicted identity in the modern world?
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying DC politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.